Coming up in today's Ideaspace podcast.
There are lots of opportunities come at my co-founder in Alban, Janne, he always says that in every uncertainty, there's an opportunity. You've just got to spot it. You need to make sure you have your IP in order. Because if someone's going to find a reason not to do a deal, they will come hard on your IP. It allowed me enough breathing space to go and set up something myself.
Yeah.
And that's when I thought, okay, what do I want to do? And I really enjoy working with founders and innovation. So therefore, setting up Basque was a bit of a no-brainer.
Welcome to the Ideaspace podcast. I'm Ben Hartley, head of Ideaspace. Ideaspace is a community of entrepreneurs, founders and their teams, many of them working alongside each other in one of our three offices based in and around Cambridge. Our members share knowledge, experience and expertise to help themselves and others in their high-impact venture creation. Our guest today is Christian Bunke, a seasoned founder and intellectual property expert with well over two decades in the startup trenches, from launching ventures out of Cambridge to selling tech to Apple. Along with all of that, Christian is an advisor and mentor and an active part of the entrepreneurial ecosystem. He's been 100% in the arena. In this Business Basics episode, Christian shares his war stories, big wins, and practical advice on everything from trademarks to trade secrets, including the real story behind a startup that quietly helped shape today's legal tech landscape. If you've ever wondered when to file a patent, how to avoid costly IP mistakes, or what happens when you believe someone might have procured your idea, this one's for you. Right. Hello, Christian. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me, Ben, as always.
I thought, because there's probably quite a lot that people don't know about you in terms of, you're quite well known in the Cambridge ecosystem and beyond with regards to intellectual property with your various IP firms that you've set up. But they might not know about kind of how you got there and the fact that you've got a really incredibly interesting background, including, you're a founder and co-founder of current companies and companies gone by, also a mentor and advisor to people. So, yeah, we're going to jump around quite a bit, if that's all right.
Sounds good.
Firstly, I'm going to open with a good one. Can you tell me something about you that people don't see on LinkedIn?
Wow. I think it probably, people don't know that I have been in the startup cluster for about 25 years. Now, a lot of it's IP and it's IP focused, but people probably don't know that I have worked with startups. My background is pretty much I would do a startup and then I would go into corporate world for 2-3 years and another startup. You can probably see that on my LinkedIn, but you can't see all of the journeys that have taken place. So a good one, for example, coming out of the Judge Business School, we thought there was a lack of connecting founders or, startup tech companies together with MBA graduates. So I think it was 2001, we set up something. We got support from Walter Harriott at St. John Innovation Center. I got to present to the King of Sweden, which is pretty cool when you're a Swede.
Yeah.
I couldn't tell anyone because that was when 9/11 was happening. I told my grandmother because I still thought my 90-year-old grandmother really needed to know this. And she said, oh, that's really cool. Your uncle Leif also met him 20 years ago. It was a pretty cool concept. We were just building a platform and we wanted to connect and make sure the ecosystem worked better.
Oh, so it's like a sort of networking or social media type.
Yeah, this was the dot-com boom when the dot-com boom was happening. And I was doing it with Richard Delabarca. So Richard Delabarca at the time was doing Artemy, which was a fabless semiconductor play. And Terry Yeo, who ended up going over to Boston and setting up his Fusion Optics, which is his startup over there. And we had a few competitors pop up over in the US at the time. We thought, okay, we need to be creative here. We need to counter these guys. So we set up Oxford Mines and London Mines.
Wow.
But we never really saw what was coming. So we went off and did real startups. So I went off and joined SmartBead at the Babraham doing multiplex bioassays. And Richard did Artemy and Terry did Fusion Optics, and the competitor at that time was Facebook, but we just couldn't see it.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. That's fascinating. So it's been, well, I was going to say it's been in your blood, but I mean, were you always entrepreneurial as a youngster? Is that something that people might have thought you would have done?
No, so my first degree is in engineering, and I don't think, I actually don't see myself as a serial entrepreneur. I see myself as a startup enthusiast.
Okay.
Because I work with so many amazing people who cure cancer or come up with new renewable energy, all of these sort of cool technology stuff. So I see myself more as a supporter of all of these founders, especially now and later in the years. But I've thought about this quite a few times, why I've done this. And I think in some ways I've probably done it because I've got a very, you know, good backing from my family, even back to my parents supporting me. But we all have our different journey.
Mm. So let's go, we'll start at square one almost by trying to find out or answer what even is IP in the context of a startup. So there'll be lots of people that will hear IP or intellectual property, but won't, you know, and they'll maybe know that you need to trademark a name.
Yep.
Or something. But
yep.
Yeah, can you just give us a sort of a, yeah, in the context of a startup, what would IP mean?
So everyone has IP, and the definition, I think, by WIPO is that it's a creation of the mind that's used commercially. So that means that you're always creating IP. If it goes back to the simple things of your material, your presentations, your brand, as you said, even inventions, etc. And it starts all the way from copyright. When you create that straight away, you can put copyright, you put your C and your company name and year, or your name and year, and then you've got that right secured. Copyright's super interesting and super cool now with AI and LLMs and you know, where the content is coming from. And then your trademarks is, you know, your name, your brand, your strap line. Trademark filings are still increasing globally. But I had some discussions with some really cool people last week, and it's actually becoming what we in Swedish say, färskvara. It's becoming a fresh produce in a sense, because only 3% of trademarks are renewed past the 10 years, and you can renew trademarks every 10 years for perpetuity. But it really shows that things are speeding up, and your brand and your campaigns are much, much shorter now.
Mm. So what was the sort of light bulb moment that led you to start your own IP firm specifically? So you'd obviously, you'd worked as an IP attorney, hadn't you, in early 90s. Yeah. So that's where you got your grounding.
Yeah.
Really.
So I was a Swedish patent attorney in the 90s and went through the sort of trainee programs over there. Then moved to Cambridge to do an MBA. I came to Cambridge thinking I was going to go and join a Swedish multinational, travel around the world, work for, I don't know, Electrolux or something. But no, I jumped. There was the recession and the dot-com crash, and one of the startups, SmartBeed, Caroline Gary there, offered me a job to come and join a startup. So that's what I did. I think the light bulb moment looking back at it, I've more or less got 7-year blocks of when I'm doing something. Mm. But I always set up companies, and a lot of them crashed. It was after we sold Sivon Innovation, which I did with Jan Altonen and Sami Saru. And that was with Pekka Lapietila, who was the former president of Nokia. We sold that one to Apple 2010. And at that point, Jana said he didn't want to go back to a big company like Nokia. I said, okay, I don't want to go back to it. So I set up Bask at that time.
Okay. There's a lot to unpack there in a great way. So you sold this company,
yeah,
which was your first kind of
successful one, probably the first successful exit, because it's something you can always, you can, you know, if I'm sitting in a meeting and I can say we sold a company to Apple, it ticks a box, but it's, you know, people don't know the real story behind it. We were, you know, there was the financial crisis, 2008, 2009. This was sort of 2010. It was a really tough market to be. The mobile phone wars were happening. Mm. But it was it was a great success. Great to have been working with the Nokia guys, and it allowed me enough breathing space to go and set up something myself.
Yeah,
and that's when I thought, okay, what do I want to do? And I really enjoy working with founders and innovation. So therefore, setting up Basque was a bit of a no-brainer.
Yeah, yeah. So less of a light bulb in that sense, and more of a, you know, it makes sense. Yeah. All coming together at one point. What would you say the scariest part of launching your own company is, and what made it worth it?
I think when you start your own company, there is, you know, you have to have an idea and you want to go with it. No one really understands what you go through unless you've done it yourself. And let's face it, Basque is simple, right? Because it's a consultancy, it's a law firm, right? It's not, we're not having to come up with the next, cure for cancer or algorithms and these sort of things. So I think it still took 3 years without having any income of really being able to do it. You have to work as hard as working for three people before you can hire the first one. Basque is great. You know, it's worth it because we now are in Sweden, Poland, UK, of course, and India. We're about 100 people globally, and we're doing fine. We're supporting amazing startups. We've worked with more than 600 startups that have been super successful. So I think it's worth it, but it's a very hard starting journey.
Mm. That hard that you started another one.
Yes. So actually, when I started Basque, I was also doing Innova Power, which is actually why I ended up at Ideaspace, because Innova Power was a hydrogen generation startup in renewable energy. We thought hydrogen was the thing. We didn't realize we were 15 years before the market was ready for it. But that one was done with a few other, Mark Naylors and a few other guys, Bob Jennings as well. The other one we started Alban about 2015. And Alban's a legal tech play. We thought there were a lot of legal tech startups in that wave. You know, there was Thought River, there was, I think Luminance was a similar time as well. And Alban was set up to be a, software services and tools for driving innovation. So enabling inventors to change the world. That is our vision.
I hope you've got some sort of copyright on there.
We file our trademarks, but yeah, we have our granted AI patents as well on patent drafting and other things. But yeah, it's cool.
Yeah, I'll ask a little bit more about both those companies, and you've helped, and the companies have helped, lots of startups in through Ideaspace and others in the ecosystem that that we know about. So, this isn't meant to be a plug, but you have helped a lot of founders, which is appreciated for sure. You've seen both sides of the table as a founder, as an advisor. How has being a founder shaped how you approach IP advice today? So when you're advising people, maybe not through the business, but on your own as you do?
Look, I think, so we try to give back as much as we can. So we're doing quite a bit of mentoring and support through all of the amazing programs that exist in Cambridge with, there's Ideaspace, there's Impulse, there's Ignite, there's Accelerate Cambridge. There's lots and lots of amazing, even, Deep Tech Labs has come in as well, where I know Stuart and Miles work with that. So it's worked with that. So it's, we advise lots of startups, founders. Interestingly enough, we do a lot of Cambridge companies, but it's not, we are global. So we work with, we're doing a lot of cool stuff in India at the moment where we're setting up a deep tech hub and really making sure we're working with all of the deep tech startups over in India as well.
Any sort of oh crap moments in your journey where IP's played a key role, either good or bad?
I think I think the interesting thing about IP is that it's not doesn't really follow any cycle, economic cycles, because there's always, I think coming back to your question earlier, how do you advise founders and what about what should people think about with IP? You know, you need to make sure you have your IP in order. Because if someone is going to find a reason not to do a deal, they will come hard on your IP. So by having it all in order and having strong IP is super important. But at the same time, I see people spending too much money on their IP in the early stages. You've got to get product market fit, and you've got to get sales and revenues in or funding in. It just, you know, so there's been plenty of crikey moments where, but it's often related. Nowadays, it's often then related to the startup and the founders that we work and support with building their IP, where either there's people infringing, often it's people taking the IP from the founders that we support.
And how would one know if their startup has IP that's worth protecting? I know that's probably a difficult question, but
no, I think it's, you know, you should do the basics, right? So you should put your trademarks in place. You should be filing your initial patents. I mean, I've got more or less a standard order for anyone who has five patents in the sort of AI space. I have buyers for that over in the US. The reason they say five patent families is that if you have that and you go into a battle, two of them will probably be invalidated or taken out. Third one will be easy to design around, and you're left negotiating with two, right? So it's about building a portfolio, not overextending yourselves, looking at the key markets. So US, Europe used to be, when I started in this job, it was US, Europe and Japan. Now it's US, Europe and China. There's been a little bit of drop off from China in the last few years, but China's still doing an amazing job in innovating and stuff.
And what's the bare minimum a founder should know about IP or their IP before they pitch to investors? Is there a point that they, you know, that their knowledge should be extensive and what they're protecting should be in place before they speak to investors? Is that an expectation?
Look, I think it's, you know, you could go to any IP expert. They will give you their time initially to talk you through and know what you need to be having in place. And there are tons. When I was in the startups I was running or founding, then we used amazing. There are lots of really good IP firms all around. There are some really simple stuff that people should be doing. So, you know, get your trademarks filed. You can ask for some support from some IP firm or IP person to look it over. Manage your costs. Even when I joined SmartBeat, I used one of the IP firms and I got stung badly because I didn't put a limit on the costs, and that was after starting life as a patent attorney, so pretty ridiculous. They're great support. So you've got the IP Advanced grant system from the UK IPO and the government. So they give you the IP audit's $3,000 and the IP access is $4,500. And that's a little bit of match funding, but you can do a lot with that. So, you get your first filings done, so you have some assets, and also then you have a good plan in place, what you're doing and why you're doing it. Too many people probably leave it a little bit too late, and it's only a quick chat with someone who knows and done it before, and people will give you time if you ask them for it.
So in terms of mistakes, I'm sort of staying on the IP advice for founders whilst we're on that. And what's one mistake that you wish every founder would avoid when it comes to trademarks or patents?
Look, I think you should always file your trademarks. I've had too many cases, even good friends of mine who have not filed their trademarks. And then even people that they collaborate go and file the same trademarks later on and basically take it. And if you're second in, it's like domain names, you know, first come, first serve. Still, you don't have to overextend and have global protection, but you need to file your trademarks. Similarly, the same with patents. don't
so,
go.
So trademark. I mean, just to touch on again. So trademarks are the things like the brand or the writing or the log line or the words. It's not the actual innovations or the technology.
It's your brand. It's your trademark. It's your strap line. It's your it's your campaign. You know, and we've worked with some really cool people, and often we're working with some really big players in the sort of even cosmetic space and fashion, and there we need to be clearing the trademarks before they put their stuff out there. But just make sure that you've got the rights before you get going and secure it. Also, if you do run into trouble where someone else is, you know, coming into your space, and you know, it's normally better to rebrand than to have the big litigation costs associated or fighting, especially when you're a small player. Yeah. I do think the also getting something filed for a patent. A patent's confidential for 18 months, but it needs to be new when you file it, right? So you should be filing something. The US are pretty good with their provisional filings in the US. It gives you something. I sometimes laugh and also cry over Cambridge because you've got so many super bright people and they go, oh, it's a patent, I'll draft it myself. and that's fine. But, you know, then you end up having to tidy it up at, you know, 12 months from that filing. Yeah. But we're trying to do our bit with that as well. So we've seen a lot of founders who are sort of quite desperate and saying, look, I don't have $5,000 for a patent. So I'm not going to tell anyone about it. And
it's hard to sell what you're doing if you can't.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And therefore we put Heroes to Carbon Zero in place for that with Basque, which is where we give away a free patent draft for people who's got something that's really inventive. And we feel that the founder and the team are solid enough. So that's really cool. We've done about 25 of those. Wow. And that's Sustainable Development Goal 13, so climate action, and Sustainable Development Goal 9, innovation and infrastructure. Because at the time we had an office in Brazil as well. So, you know, for India and Brazil, innovation and infrastructure is a big thing, as well as climate action now, of course. But yeah.
In fact, just you touched on costs, because there'll be people out there, myself included. I've had brief encounters with it where I've trademarked a number of things for previous businesses. But for a sort of startup that might be coming out of an academic or a research environment like this, how much should an early stage startup actually budget for IP? For IP protection generally. I know it's going to vary hugely, but there'll be people who won't know ballparks.
Yeah, look, I think, you know, the first stage you could probably get done for $5,000 or $10,000, right? So you get your trademarks filed, your first patent, this sort of stuff. Then as long as you've filed something, you're in the race, right? There will be coming costs at 6 months and at 12 months for trademarks and patents, but that again, you can adjust how much you're spending. But once you get to sort of $15,000, $20,000, $25,000, you're going to be fine getting stuff in place. The problem you have is that for SEIS funding now, you know, people doing their $250,000 or then going into the EIS space for the funding, you don't want to be spending all of your money, or, you know, you should be spending a lot more on your product development and marketing and stuff than your IP protection, you know.
And that's good advice coming from yourself with huge amounts of experience. You know, there's no point in protecting something that's never one's ever going to know about it.
No, and I think, you know, you've got to be brave as well, right? And even this everything is speeding up. So, and I do think it's important. Depends on what phase you're at with the company as well. I think there's a big missed opportunity in the UK from SMEs and sort of established businesses not taking use of patent box, which lowers your corporation tax to 10% if you have a patented product and the revenues are touched by that patent. But for startups, it's a different world, right? That's making sure you've got enough in place to raise money. You need to be able to have a good answer for freedom to operate, because that also goes into your Horizon and UK Innovate UK grants, that you need to be able to say that you have freedom to operate because you're aware of the landscape, the academics, the competitors. So you have freedom to operate to the best of your knowledge.
Right. We've got a number of founders who are hell-bent on NDAs.
Yep.
Are they a useful tool or a sort of false sense of security? Do they sort of force people? Because I know there are some investors out there who you know, get a little bit frustrated that they can't speak to someone about something. It's just like, just tell me your idea. Yeah. You know, early on in that kind of almost elevator pitch. Yeah.
So many investors won't sign NDAs with you because they have, you know, hundreds of thousands of proposals flying through their desk. I think it's good practice to put an NDA in place, but I wouldn't overhype it. The longest time I took to sign an NDA was with, I think it's, well, call it a large, well, it's probably, I took 3 months to sign an NDA with Sony once. And it was just, I wasn't rushing it, but it's, I often say, make sure you sign the NDA of the other party if they're a big company, because otherwise you have to go, they have to go back into legal to get your startup NDA through their legal, and it's never going to happen. So, well, it will happen, but it will take 3 months. So on NDAs, make sure you have them in place. People are, you know, it's not in the interest of many large multinationals to steal your stuff, because their brand reputation is way too big. Our industry is regulated and you know, has code of practice across Europe and UK and other locations. VCs will want to see your stuff and see if it's investable or not. But then if you haven't signed an NDA, you just control how much you disclose. Yeah. What you need to do is you need to take a quick look at it and make sure that there's no, you know, there have been NDAs that I haven't signed when the other party, basically in Alban's discussion with other partners, where there are things in there saying, okay, if we litigate, you're going to cover my costs, right? But that's common sense. And never sign, my dad once said to me, don't do bad business, right? So don't sign it if it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. And on that sort of, touching on that, I guess, what should founders do if someone does, I say, steal their idea? If someone's idea or branding is used in a way that they feel is not right, what's the first step they should do?
Well, so you've always got to keep good record. So the records you have of people that you've spoken to or you've disclosed information, and make sure you've marked those with your, you know, your copyright and your company name and year, and that they're confidential, especially if you're doing this under an NDA, of course. And you know, it's a cease and desist letter. So there's different ways you do this. It's cease and desist letter and the lawyers get involved. I've had quite a bit of experience with patent trolls as well. In that case, you've got to just, it becomes it's a bit of an extortion situation. Okay. Really.
So a patent troll, what
so patent trolls are non-practicing entities, is the more formal name. And that is people who have the IP rights and then come after you to block you or ask for you. So most companies that are going to do an IPO, so an initial public offering, they will get a knock on their door from companies who have IP that they are infringing, and they're saying, pay up or you're not going to do an IPO. So I have lots of experiences of these things. I went and saw a very large mobile phone manufacturer in Asia, and I said to them, look, guys, you need to have IP, otherwise you're going to be in trouble when you do your IPO, because the big guys have IP and we can help you get this in place. I saw their head of IP, who was a trademark person, and didn't understand what a patent was. And 3 months later, they went to do their IPO. 6 months later, they were dead. Because the Ericsson, I think it was, came and said, you're not listing and without owning, you know, important IP.
Wow. It's amazing to think that something so advanced or...
I mean, maybe it's a bit harsh to say they were not around, but the IPO got pulled and they're much, much smaller. And they weren't able to you know, continue on the growth path.
And what happens when a company or a startup has got IP and they pivot to something where their IP is now...
Yeah.
What happens in that?
I've sat in another board meeting with a startup company in Sweden, and they had a large multinational as an investor, and the new CEO was very excited and talked about how he has, you know, all of this amazing IP. And towards the end of the board meeting, he turned to me and said, "Oh, so, you know, tell us how great our IP is, and does it all cover the new product that we're launching next month?" And I had to be honest and said, no, it doesn't, right? Because they had done that pivot, right? And that's the other thing. Don't be afraid of killing off IP. Mm. You know, same way as we're seeing this trend in trademarks where, you know, more and more trademarks are being filed, but it's much faster turnaround. And it's the same with patents. You need to file your patents, but they're also publishing at 18 months. If you want to decide to keep something as a trade secret, you pull it, right? You don't let it publish. Mm.
And so where does trade secret fit into?
Yeah, so I used to not be so big on trade secrets. I used to say it's very hard to control because people leave the company and they take it along with them. It's quite funny. So as soon as you have a successful company, there'll be competitors popping up, and it's often employees or people who have seen what you're doing who says, we can do that as well. Mm. And therefore you need to, now it's super important to lock down your trade secrets and have everyone respect your agreements that you have in your employment contracts. Yeah.
What's the difference with trade secret and a patented
Your trade secret will be something. One company we worked with in Sweden, again, this is to the start of my career, they basically had their manufacturing process protected by trade secret. There were only certain employees who went behind the curtain where that machine was running, and they had a patent in the drawer ready to file if they thought the competitor were getting close to them. But because patents now publish at 18 months, you've got to be careful with what you put into them. Another example is when the patent wars were happening, the big multinationals or the big mobile phone companies had 50 engineers sitting in India reading every patent that was published to know what was happening. Well, that's now a click of a button. Yes, there might be a bit of hallucination, but the LLMs and the AI will be spitting out all of that information in just a few seconds. So last week we filed a patent for three different versions of the same invention because we know we've got to be... we've got to be wary of this and decide later on what we let publish and not.
Jeez, it's a minefield. Get advice, everyone. Anyone who's listening, just get advice. And then what happens if someone's got IP? Can you sell it on? Someone's got a tagline or a logline that they've trademarked in something, and then they stop that thing?
There's a pretty decent market on brokering, on IP brokering. You know, a lot of the brands get sort of sold on and divested. And that's also why I say the IP industry is a little bit, not so dependent upon economic cycle, because even when you get into trouble or you're closing down your business, your IP can often be sold off if it's good IP. Mm. So there are specialists who broker the Sivan Innovation sale to Apple. Was we had a very large patent portfolio and Apple bought it. It's a little bit tricky. It's hard to sell patents because it's a bit like walking around with a loaded gun and saying, do you want to buy this? Mm. Everything's possible.
Okay. I actually wanted to, you touched on AI, and I'm interested how that's upending or changing the industry, but I just want to briefly just sort of leap back onto something else.
Yep.
And that's you as a founder and CEO. Because this podcast is listened to by potential and current yep. CEOs and picking up advice. What's a normal day for you as the CEO of a company?
So I try to start the day early. So I try to be in the office by 8 o'clock. I'm possibly a little bit disorganized. So it is sometimes I have a problem where I jump onto the latest email that pops up and action need to be actioned. So the the most important thing, and this was told to me by my co-founder of Alban, Jan Alton, and he always says, make sure you get one thing done every day. And Marcelo Motta, who's my other business partner with Basque, he always says, his father used to say to him, make sure you do the most important stuff in the morning, first time, right? So you get it done. There's always something that comes up, something that needs to be handled or needs to be looked after. I still engage with quite a few clients where I'm involved and heavily involved in their IP strategy and these sort of things, which I think is exciting. And that's what gives me a buzz, right? Mm. But I've got an amazing business partner in Govan Kedia over in India who runs the whole team over in Delhi. He's doing an amazing job. And even the European office is running their own clients and stuff. So,
So your the strategy and key decisions you're making, but you've gotten big enough now that you're, more of a CEO of a corporate rather than a.
Well, I think, to be honest, I think sometimes you've got to keep the hustle. You know, I think that's very important. Mm. And if you become too sort of big picture, etc., you lose a little bit of the cold front, you know, your cold faces. So I do think I do still get involved. There are a few clients that I really enjoy working with and staying involved and heavily involved with. And that's also when they get involved with things like litigation and other things, then it's super, because I know it's business critical for them. So we work hard to support them.
Yeah. And do you find that that you just picked up lots along the way as being, and I mean with the sort of CEO hat on, and the reason I'm asking the questions is we get founders that they might be academics or they might be technical specialists, engineers or developers or whatever they might be, and they end up running a company.
Yeah.
You know, they set up the company, they don't know how quickly it's going to grow or how big it's going to grow, and then suddenly they've got a 10 people that they're hiring and their job changes completely. Is that something that you found incrementally?
Yeah, so I think for every startup, when I talk to founders and when we have these, you know, and they go through these startup programs in that there are plenty in Cambridge, right? Really good ones. I think always take the advice you get from people or mentors with a pinch of salt, because no one knows your business as well as you do. But you should listen to it, and then you should figure out whose advice you should be taking on board. Every startup you do, you get some sort of gold nugget. So when I came out of SmartBead, I felt that, yes, it's really about having the best team. You have to have a really good team, and you've got to have the right backers, because otherwise you get put over the barrel with a convertible loan and they bleed you out, right, as a founder. So similarly, you know, longer I went, I also got to the point where I'm like, you know, you need to have a co-founder. I think it's just too tough as an individual to do it. Some amazing single founders out there, and I, you know, support them as much as we can, but otherwise your wife ends up being your co-founder, and your after dinner discussions become very, very boring.
In fact, how do you're juggling a lot? It seems you never seem like, whenever I see you, you never seem like you're juggling a lot. You always seem very relaxed and chilled out. But how do you manage that that kind of interface between your personal life and work life? Is it something that has sort of molds into one and you deal with it, or do you have fine lines that separate the two?
I used to work more in the evenings before, and I think probably that shifted a little bit around COVID time. I do try to, you know, the advice from my amazing wife is, you know, be present. And that's important. I like sports, so I try to spend a lot of time with the kids doing sports and stuff on the weekends. And you have to, I talked about this a lot with my team. So I think it was one of the presentations at the Judge Business School where one of the big CEOs had said, I can't manage my time, but I can manage my energy levels. Mm. So I think that's a big one. we spoke here before we started the podcast about, yeah, we need to get fit and get back into the gym, right? So, you need to manage your energy levels. And similarly to my team, I say, I want them to take their holiday. I want them to really take their holiday and go away. And yes, sometimes you need to get them, but then you get them on a text, right? Or a phone call rather than them having to check emails when they're out.
So jumping back, I said that we might just sort of touch on AI. Yeah. How is AI or LLMs or...
Yeah.
Yeah. How's it affecting or disrupting what you do?
Yeah. I think it's super cool. I do think I have reflected a few times that it sort of almost feels like history is repeating itself with the dot-com boom. With what was coming along, we couldn't really see what was happening. And many people talk about Amazon back then, you know, how no one could see that they were more than a online bookstore, right? So I do think we're seeing that again. It's much faster turnaround time. The speed of acquiring knowledge is speeding up. People will still be using... You know, IP rights are still going to be super important, but it's probably shifted a little bit more towards trade secrets than being a little bit more tactics, I would say, rather than strategy on how you go about filing patents, where you file, how many patents you file. From our profession, for the IP attorneys, patent attorneys, trademark attorneys, it's really going to be a big shift, but we've seen that. We were speaking already 2018, 2019, because we saw this with Alban, right? That there's a real, that these tools are coming, and we've always tried to innovate and stay ahead ourselves. So we're Basque's part of some really cool UK Innovate grant R&D projects as well that we're doing, looking at valuation of IP and even drafting tools are becoming very good.
Mm. And is current IP law, is it robust enough to deal with what's coming or not?
It's always catching up. Right. So the pendulum always swings, I say. So it's it tries to adjust, and the UK IPO came along the lines with, you know, if you have an artificial neural network, an ANN, you've got technical effect in a sense. So that was a few years ago now. And Europe came more in line with, well, US and then US, it's everything fluctuates. But quality IP will always be needed. But then it's, at the end of the day, it's about execution and building your business and having that market pool, right? Where it's amazing. The unicorns we work with and the companies that have exited for billions, it just takes off. And then it's all hands to the pumps, and you've got to make sure you have things in place.
Yeah. So just lighten things slightly, maybe. I don't know. What's the most bizarre or unexpected IP issue that you've come across? Is there anything that's kind of...
I would probably, it's a bit like the shoemaker's shoes, right? I do think sometimes... I have good friends of mine who have been doing their business, and you take a normal IP attorney's approach and they ask you about a trademark and you say, don't worry about it. It's so descriptive. No one's going to trademark this. And then someone else comes along and does it. And therefore, I think it's, almost the Americans are amazing. They're paranoid, right? That they don't want anyone else stealing it. The Koreans as well, and others as well. That I think sometimes maybe we're a little bit too relaxed, rock and roll in the UK. I love the UK. I've been here for 25 years. But I do think you just got to sometimes make sure you have the right thing in the right place.
Do people ever, are there, like domain names where people just see a company that's about to be and they...
For sure.
They do that with trademarks.
They're basically bots that are running. As soon as you file a trademark, the .com domains are registered in different locations. And even people doing business in different countries, you go in there and you haven't filed your domain. Have a domain name, but you don't file your trademark. And then you basically get a letter from, sometimes it's even your distributor, right? So who's filed a trademark for your company, no product name. And you need to then start untangling it all.
Just it's a a minefield.
But there's some really cool things. So we're super lucky to be working with innovation and all of these super cool founders. I did have a really nice moment when I was in my wife's Australian. I was waking up on the 1st of January 2021, and it said the newspaper, the small little newspaper in Adelaide, the Advertiser, was saying the 10 most disruptive innovations of the decade. And I opened the newspaper, and there was our client, Musa Meat, with Professor Prost holding his lab-grown beef burger on the front page of the newspaper on the other side of the planet. And that makes you smile a little bit that, you know, great to be working with all of these cool companies and doing amazing things.
And especially given you're a founder yourself and advisor and now working with all those innovations.
Yeah,
you've been on both sides. So yeah, we're not completely out of time, enough to sort of pick your brains a little bit more. So I think I'm just gonna get some reflections from you in a way. What would you go back and tell yourself 20 years ago?
So I had this discussion a few weeks ago, or even it's probably a few months ago now, what would we have done differently, or what would I have done differently? I think it's when you're looking at everything in the rear vision mirror, it's if any of the companies, the startups I'd been involved with in the early days had been a huge success, I would, of course, been saying, I wouldn't have changed a thing, right? But I do think advice I would have given myself was sometimes to be, I was 38 before I started Bask. And yes, I had done 3 or 4 startups before that. I'd been an early employee in a startup like SmartBead. And then we had started four or five small little ventures on the side of that, you know, Vapower, Camshaw, a few other ones. And I think my advice to myself would be I should have been brave enough to go all in on and focus, because you often lose out on opportunities because you're not focused enough. And if you're focused enough, I think it was Sunil Shah who said to me when we were starting to go into India, so Sunil and Prashant, of course, are O2H here. Mm. And he looked at me a little bit like, you're going to lose your shirt when you go to India, buddy. But he then also said, you'll be fine. You just got to go for it, and you got to stay focused. Mm. So I think that's find something. I used to play a lot of sports, and I do think you get a bit of an adrenaline rush and competitiveness from sports. And therefore, when I'm doing my startups now, or I'm supporting startups, it's about building a team, building a high performance culture, and not being afraid to pivot and change, right? Mm. And you've got to be really listening to your customers.
Mm. IP in 3 emojis.
I think I'd give it the V sign, because at the end of the day, it can be the thing that makes or breaks, you know, when there's a great exit, a great success, you know, then you know you've done well enough. I'd also give it the sort of the emoji with the straight mouth, whatever that means, because it's one of these. I can also turn this around and say IP is your insurance, right? So we're basically, you know, when you're young and you're starting off, you don't need house insurance, life insurance, etc. But you need that in place when you've started to buy a house or you've got a family. And I think you have to think about this a little bit in the same way. Mm. Don't be afraid of it. Just go for it. And then the fist pump, I think, because you've got to be able to, you know, fist pump in the sense of your collaborators, your team, your drive innovation internally. Because if you're innovative, you're gonna succeed, and you get the product market fit. But I also think the fist pump emoji also tells you, you know, sometimes you've got to be tough, and you've got to send those cease and desist letters, and you've got to go, not be afraid of litigating and enforcing your rights. Why do you have them otherwise?
Mm. Good answers. In terms of books or podcasts or newsletters, have you got anything that you'd recommend for someone who wants to
I'd always like to think that I would read more than what I do. I don't. But I think Build by Tony Fadell is a great read. I've even implemented a few of his things. I also know a few people in his book, so that's a nice read when you're reading something you had business dealings with some of them. So he's got a really good book. He says when you get sued, you celebrate, you pop the champagne, because that means you're doing something well, right? Mm-hmm. And similarly, he talks a lot about, for us in our world, the IP world is problem solution. So what is your problem that you're solving and what's the solution you come? So he's the inventor of the iPod and then later on the founder of Nest. So he came and spoke at the Cambridge Union a few years ago and it was a really good presentation.
Yeah, wow. And how about one word to describe the current state of the startup world?
I would say that the current state of the startup world, it's super exciting, right? I know that's two words, but...
We'll give you two.
Yeah, super exciting. Words. I think we've got to support founders. We've got to have founders got to create these new businesses that we can't even see, right? We are back at sort of 2001 or even maybe 99, 2000, right? There are lots of opportunities come at my co-founder in Alban, Jan, he always says that in every uncertainty, there's an opportunity. You've just got to spot it. So yeah, we're going to have purpose and we've got to drive the ability and willingness to create more startups, because that's how we're going to create jobs and be competitive.
Yeah, that's again another excellent answer. We're in this current state of affairs and across the world, we need to innovate. We need founders to create. We need to embrace them, encourage them, foster, support.
Absolutely,
entrepreneurship and entrepreneurial activity as well. Something founders should worry less about.
I almost want to say IP, right? But it's, look, I think it's IP is there. There's always IP in anything you do, but you've got to get on with business. If you become too worried about it, you've just got to push ahead and bring in people to handle it. Often the CEO or CTO becomes a bottleneck when the company grows too much and they're trying to hold on and do all of the IP as well, but they've got to be able to let go, says the CEO, who many of my colleagues say that I should not be micromanaging, right? So, yeah.
And something founders should worry more about?
I think founders should always be keeping two, if not three, parallel tracks on their funding. So there's so many, and we see it all happening all the time, where you think you've got your A round, your 10 million in the bank, and it's all going to happen. And then because of people, it doesn't come off, and it's often something unforeseen. But some of the best founders we work with, they've always got two, maybe even three, parallel tracks running. So if you do not close this funding, what do you revert back to? Well, you've got the parallel track of a grant coming in, or you have got the agreement with, you know, some existing investors to get that bridge loan in place so that you don't run off out of runway.
So where can people find out more about you or follow what you're up to?
So I'm around the place I try to be around at some of the Cambridge events and stuff like that. And please just come up and talk to me. And similarly, it's, you know, there I'm on Twitter, I'm on LinkedIn, sorry, X, and LinkedIn and emails. I'm very contactable on email and my mobile phone, which is out there.
Yeah. Great. Thank you. Finally, cause we're wrapping up, it's time has whizzed by. Any sort of projects that you're excited about right now or things in the pipeline that you're working on?
So look, I think there's huge opportunity right now in AI and quantum computing, where we're lucky enough to be working with Quantinuum and some other newer, smaller startups. AI, again, Fetch AI we work with, which is super cool. And I think there's going to be something that plays out geopolitically as well. But I don't think founder startups should worry too much about it. You should keep your options open and just set a plan. And like my co-founder Jana says, now we have a plan, now we execute.
Yeah, love that. Great way to finish. It's been absolutely fascinating talking with you. We could have done a whole podcast on your time with startups or starting up your own things, but it's been great to tap into your vast knowledge and experience with IP related issues as well. So thank you for that. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure to be here as well. And big supporter of Ideaspace and some of the other initiatives that you're working on.
Thanks. Thanks so much, Christian.
Thank you.
For more information or any inquiries about joining Ideaspace, please contact us via ideaspace.cam.ac.uk or via any of our social media channels.